You are listening to Social Europe Podcast. We discuss cutting-edge thinking on politics, economy, and employment and labour with some of the most thought-provoking people around, including Nobel Prize winners and other internationally acclaimed experts. So welcome and enjoy the conversation.
This episode of Social Europe Podcast is brought to you by the Zayed Business School, University of Oxford. Maximize your effectiveness in the changing global business environment with the postgraduate Oxford Diploma in Global Business. Taught in four short modules over a year, the program is designed to accelerate your career and increase your impact while minimizing the disruption to your work and family life. Learn alongside senior executives from around the world and develop a lifelong network. Visit the Oxford Diploma in Global Business website to find out more. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Social Europe Podcast, episode 49. My name is Henning Meyer, editor-in-chief of Social Europe. Today, I'm in conversation with David Bach, who is a professor in the practice of management and deputy dean for executive programs at the Yale School of Management. We are talking about the role of companies in society and why the future of companies lies in being a political company and what this actually means. I hope you enjoy the conversation. So, David Bach, thank you very much indeed for taking the time today to talk to me about the business government and the business social stakeholder relationship and how it is actually changing. And to get us started, I mean, if we look at recent developments in the economy, sometimes dubbed as capitalism without capital, i.e., you know, economies are becoming much more reliant on intangible assets, which also include reputation, brand, and other things. How do you see that the business wider stakeholder relationship is changing in the wake of these developments?
Yeah, it's such a critical change, right? You know, it's sometimes we oversimplify if we say this is how it used to be and this is how it is now. But if we just sort of paint with broad strokes here, you know, in a previous era, when perhaps a lot more consumption was focused on tangible products, and the information in particular consumers had available was more limited, you know, you would basically have competition being about, you know, quality and price and perhaps availability, to some extent brand, that certainly mattered. But, you know, we used to teach this in business schools, you know, it's about quality and price and availability and distribution and so on. What we see now is, of course, you know, services becoming much more important, intangible products becoming much more important. But in addition, intangible attributes of companies becoming much more important. And some of that has to do with the much greater information that consumers have at their disposal. And so suddenly it isn't just about, do I like this product? Is it affordable to me? Is it available to me in terms of, you know, distribution channels? But rather, how do I feel about this company? What do I know about them? What are my thoughts about the company's leadership? You know, how do I think about their role in my community, for example? And so all of a sudden, factors, variables that in the past probably wouldn't have driven a lot of consumer behavior are coming into play. And that means that a whole range of other stakeholders, you know, NGOs, activists, others, now have the opportunity to leverage this greater awareness that consumers can have about companies to actually exert pressure on companies to change their behavior. And so it's a very different paradigm in many ways.
And of course, you know, being more reliant on intangible assets and digital technology means the scalability of business is also on a completely different scale, with which you then run into all sorts of different sort of intercultural problems, you know, varieties of interpretations of these relationships across the world. Would you see that like this as well?
Absolutely. I mean, so we have multiple paradigm shifts, right? So one was, you know, the greater availability of information to consumers. We'll talk later on, I'm sure, about employees and shareholders. But you're absolutely right about the role of sort of going global. Again, you know, 10, 15 years ago, in a lot of MBA curricula, for example, we'd have a separate course on international business. There was sort of the idea that you decided as a company at some point when to go abroad. And there's a whole literature about market entry modes and how do you do that and how do you sequence it and how do you develop your distribution system. And, you know, and part of that then is about compliance and regulation and so on. But now, you know, so many companies are, to use a cliche, born digital. They put their product on the App Store or Google Play, and it's available in many countries around the world. Leaving aside for a moment that, you know, value chains are distributed, you know, supply chains are distributed. And so, you know, very much, you know, companies from the get-go are often dealing with the fact that, you know, they're present in multiple countries. Sometimes they're not even aware of the fact that they actually have a presence in a country. And they're being confronted with some of the norms, rules, regulations, stakeholder expectations in many of these countries. And of course, those very often are heterogeneous, and that poses some really interesting challenges for leaders.
Yeah, I mean, when I remember back to my days at business school, in my global business diploma, we were working with an article called Born Global. You know, as far as I can see, you know, academia has been reasonably good to work in what was the globalization debate into the frameworks that are being taught at business schools. But to me, you know, this interaction with the born digital, and that's still very nascent, isn't it? I mean, the nature of digital companies does not really have to do with the cultural distance and these sort of things. So they obviously interact. But what is the latest in terms of research? You know, how does that progress that was made with these frameworks under the globalization debate, how is that being developed further, you know, taking into account the digital economy?
Sure. I mean, competition, in terms of competition, of course, are different in digital. You know, some of these markets are, you know, winner-take-all markets, especially the platform markets, right? And that puts an enormous premium on sort of speed of rollout. We can talk about some of this and some of the implications. Of course, now we're seeing, at long last, the pushback against, you know, the size and the centrality of these companies, right? But there are other things that are different about these digital companies, right? Again, you know, go back to the centrality of talent. I mean, that is the scarce commodity very often. And so, I know an issue that you're very interested in is sort of issue around CEO activism and when do companies actually get involved in contentious social issues. It's no coincidence that the companies, certainly here in the U.S., who've been leading this have been technology companies because, you know, they need the best talent in their enterprises. You know, a lot of young people, millennials and others, who can take their skills and go elsewhere. And so this sort of you know, values match between the employee and the company is really important. So that's another way in which digital and technology in particular are different when it comes to how they're engaging with society and social issues.
Yeah, and there's obviously, I mean, as far as I can see, there is no alternative to being engaged in the wider stakeholder community, especially, I mean, in terms of policy making. Existing regulations are also badly lacking behind. I mean, if you look at issues like, you know, how to calculate the tax base these days, how does antitrust regulation fit the digital economy? I mean, these are just two areas where there will clearly be also development in terms of regulation and policy, and obviously companies will probably want to be involved in shaping that. So that leads me to sort of maybe strange conclusion that one of the things I'm currently working on here in Germany is there actually an alternative to a company being political, not political in the sense that it's party political, but back to the Greek origin, which means being engaged in the state affairs and public life. So the new company is a political company, isn't it?
It's such an important point. And I sometimes say to students or to executives here that, you know, we've done in management education, I think, for a long time, we've done a disservice to our students trying to sort of deliberately taking, you know, politics out of business, sort of suggesting to them that, you know, the business of business is business. And you shouldn't have to worry about politics and society. And you're absolutely right. Historically, that hasn't been the case. You know, you think of business sort of in the late 19th century, early 20th century. You know, these firms had enormous political influence and political weight. And it was sort of understood that they were political actors. And you know, my view is that there's been this you know, effort, particularly sort of in the second half of the 20th century, to try to take that out, right? So that, you know, the primacy of shareholder capitalism also led to this notion that you could safely, as a manager, ignore politics, and in fact that is what you were supposed to do, that businesses were economic entities, and we completely overlooked the fact that, you know, they're comprised of people, they're operating within the context of societies. You know, markets don't exist in a vacuum. And so absolutely, you know, business has always been political, for reasons that we can discuss. I think it's becoming more political now, but it never stopped being political. And I think, as I said before, we've done a disservice in business schools, educating leaders to think that they should shy away from that, because, you know, first of all, it's not realistic, as many of them have learned recently, and it's also not helpful for their businesses to not embrace the political role that they play, you know, both at home and abroad.
And it's actually bad for business itself. I mean, this conclusion that the future of the business of the firm is being a political firm actually came to me after I had a chat with Colin Meyer, who leads a big research project and at the British Academy in London, and they finished the first part of it, and basically is exactly what you were saying: the limitation of the purpose of business to shareholder value, which was sort of the Milton Friedmanite turn in the second half of the 20th century, that has really narrowed the view, and it has been bad for business, because as a result, yeah, business has withdrawn as a social actor. Trust in business has plummeted, and in order to survive, and, you know, we can talk about concepts like social license to operate, you know, sure, businesses need to rediscover these, yeah, roots. And you know, if you want to boil down Colin's research into one sentence, he says the businesses have to rediscover their purpose, and the purpose is to find profitable solutions to the problems of people and planet. So that means they have to be political. There's no other way.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, we can arrive at that conclusion in many different ways, right? If you ask what is political, Harold Laswell famously defined politics as who gets what, when, and how. I mean, to assume that business does not play a role in that, of course, is not being realistic and not being cognizant of the outsized influence that decision-making in businesses and by businesses has on the way societies function, you know, the way we produce, where, how, who gets employed, how much do they get paid, how does value get distributed among the various contributors, what is the impact on the planet, as you pointed out, Colin focuses on. So all of this is intensely political. BCG put out a report just a couple of years ago, I think the Henderson Institute there, and they said the title was "The Business of Business is No Longer Just Business." You know, interesting play on words. I would argue the business of business has never been, you know, just business. But as absolutely, you said, we're rediscovering that. And some of it is by enlightened business leaders, and quite a bit of it is as a result of some rude awakenings as you know, governments and civil society groups have reminded business that, you know, they're operating in a social and political context and can't escape it.
So that's a really interesting point of time when, you know, business has lost trust to an extent that they have to rediscover their historical purpose. And at the same time, we have fundamental shifts in the way the economy works, which also has a lot of impact in, you know, what the scope of business actually is.
Yeah. And I think that's right.
Yeah, go on.
Go ahead. Well, you know, for me, I mean, just as a bit of a sort of personal anecdote, perhaps, and you were talking before about technology companies. I mean, I went to Berkeley to get my PhD in the late 1990s, and I was very interested in, you know, writing a dissertation on, you know, private actors and global governance. That was sort of a hot topic in the 90s. And of course, I got to California right in the middle of the dot-com boom. And here were entrepreneurs who had very much bought into the sort of what was then referred to as a cyber libertarian ideal, that cyberspace was a distinctive space and, you know, people should stay away from it, that governments couldn't regulate it and shouldn't regulate it. And very quickly, you know, these entrepreneurs realized that was not going to be realistic. And so I vividly remember, you know, us convening sort of multi-stakeholder meetings, and you had policymakers from the U.S. and from the European Union and civil society representatives sitting around the table with business leaders talking about how are we going to, you know, protect children online? How are we going to guarantee free speech at the same time? How are we going to handle intellectual property rights? You know, how do trademarks correspond to internet domain names? What do we do about privacy? Who owns data? How we're going to collect taxes? So, you know, the thing that was fascinating about this, and really I think defies that previous paradigm, was that business was actively involved in helping to shape the rules of the game. And that there was the sense that business and government very much had that positive sum relationship in that context. And it was very different from what I had previously been taught about how business operates and what the relationship with government is. And that doesn't mean that all of the deals that were struck there, in the benefit of sort of all stakeholders equally, right? We can certainly question some of that. But what it made clear was that business was political, that particularly business at the technological frontier where innovation happens has to be engaged in political discussions, because ultimately, you know, as you disrupt, as you transform, as you challenge, you're going to have, there are going to be social and political ramifications. And so if you want to be long-term oriented, you better be engaged in those conversations, take seriously some of the concerns that arise, and work together with different stakeholders and finding solutions.
We'll come back to this point, which is very interesting. I mean, how the governance model could look like going forward in the final part. But let me, in the meantime, focus on something that you've already alluded to, that we are already seeing maybe early attempts and early initiatives by companies to be progressive, be socially proactive, engage in this sphere, sometimes also dubbed woke capitalism. So how would you sort of interpret these efforts against the backdrop that we've just discussed?
Yeah, so that's sort of the next shift, right? So what I described about California in the 90s was companies being active in areas that were directly related to their business, right? You're an internet service provider. You have some thoughts about who is liable for content on your website, for example. What's been happening over the last couple of years is that suddenly businesses are speaking out on issues that don't really seem to be directly related to their business, right? They're speaking up when it comes to LGBTQ rights. They're speaking up about issues related to immigration or healthcare or equality or, other issues of that nature. You see companies weighing in on climate change, even if they're not necessarily large manufacturing businesses or in the energy industry. In fact, again, it's often technology companies that may not have nearly as big an environmental footprint who are leading those discussions. So why is that happening? It's fascinating. And what we can clearly identify is that increasingly consumers are, as I said, paying attention to where companies stand and what CEOs say about important issues. And employees, the same. And we have some data about this, and we can talk about that. But at the same time, it comes out of some of this sort of governance vacuum that you described. In other words, because governments don't seem to be advocating as forcefully and driving change as effectively as particularly younger people would like to see, they're turning to other sources of potential authority and other sources of potential change and put pressure on business to respond. I'll give you just one example. Here in the United States, of course, you know, it is absolutely maddening that we're not making any progress when it comes to gun safety. We have mass shooting after mass shooting, and Congress, you know, throws up its hands and, you know, offers thoughts and prayers, and not a whole lot happens. And what's been happening recently is that in addition to, you know, a social movement that is trying to keep the heat up on policymakers, that same social movement has put pressure on business, you know, on banks and financial institutions to stop funding gun manufacturers, on retail outlets to convince them to adopt policies internally within their stores that are much stricter than federal policies, for example. And so that is very much about realizing that business can step up and provide governance in a situation where government is either unwilling or unable to do it.
And interestingly, I mean, maybe because of the nature of policymaking, you know, they're always one or two steps behind and trying to establish the new system. But at the same time, if you link it back to the discussion we had about the nature of the new economy, I mean, not just that there is a vacuum, but also the scale of these companies in terms of economic impact and size, sure, as well as cultural impact, given the kind of products that they produce. I mean, that also maybe even generates an expectation that they might develop, at least in some issues, a view.
Oh, absolutely. So, I mean, you look, for example, at the size and power of Walmart in the U.S. You know, Walmart, the largest private employer in the country, you know, most Americans get their groceries and a whole lot more at Walmart. You know, 10, 12 years ago, Walmart was a villain, you know, broadly across sort of the progressive world. And there's still a lot of progressives who have concerns about Walmart's wage policy and benefit policy. But environmentalists, I'm generalizing a little bit, you know, have actually found a lot of common ground with Walmart. The company has become a champion of sustainability. It makes actually sense for them from a business perspective to try to reduce waste and packaging and energy consumption because it's consistent with their low-cost model. And if you ask sort of a lot of environmental advocates whether you can drive change more quickly by getting Walmart to change some of its sourcing policy or by getting the Environmental Protection Agency to adopt a new policy or new standards, without question, it's the former. It's much faster. The scale is bigger. The impact is much more immediate. And so you've had these really interesting collaborations between companies and pressure groups and NGOs to drive change that, you know, historically we would have thought of as being the purview of government.
Yeah, and interestingly, I mean, economic levers, political levers seem to move the other way as well. I mean, there's always a discussion in public policy to use government procurement as a lever, you know, to effectively force standards into supply chains. And what you're describing is effectively the same thing, you know, applied to a very dominant economic player.
That's totally true. And again, I come back to Walmart again with their size and their influence. They have set standards on the supply chain side and have shared them widely with all of their suppliers, you know, with others. And so their standards around sustainability in the supply chain are actually reshaping, you know, manufacturing, parts of manufacturing, certainly, you know, retail, in a way that historically, you know, government proclaimed standards or government procurement would have done.
And, you know, let's come to the very tricky bit. I mean, what we so far described is basically a process within companies that they have to rediscover their traditional purposes, which basically means they have to become political, even if they don't see this as this at the moment. At the same time, we've sketched out a moving economy quickly, you know, changing into a more and more digital economy, and the lack of progress or the difficulty of policymakers to keep step with this. Yeah. So it seems obvious that going forward, in order to get a good equilibrium, that businesses and policymakers need to work together. And you've already mentioned some mechanisms that have been applied since the 90s, multi-stakeholder approaches and so on and so forth. Yeah. They have been good, as far as I can see, in terms of open deliberation, but have been lacking in terms of hard output, I would say. So how would you make this business government and business wider stakeholder relationship more effective going forward in these new circumstances?
You know, you're absolutely right. I think there is a whole lot that is positive in terms of business stepping up and accepting responsibility for their role and their impact in a way that perhaps for some time they didn't. But let's not make a mistake about this. This is entirely self-interested. I mean, this is not because they suddenly decided to act against self-interest. It is very much about consumers increasingly being aware, employees increasingly demanding their companies take a stand. The amount of money that has gone into institutional investments that are long-term oriented, that look at the environmental, social, and governance performance of companies has increased. And so, you know, CEOs have responded. They know that if they don't speak out about an important issue, an issue that is important to their employees or their customers, they might lose them. And, you know, those are critical, you know, assets for them, of course. You know, that's the whole ball game when it comes to a particularly innovative technology company, right? The quality of your staff. But just because they're doing this in a self-interested way doesn't necessarily mean that they're doing it in a socially optimal way or that this maximizes welfare. I mean, you can have market failures, if you will, within the market for, corporate social responsibility. And so there are limits as to what companies might do or the way that they might do them. And we have, lots of examples of this where, Facebook is now trying to, figure out how to properly monitor content on its side after it's been accused of turning a blind eye to hate speech, to content that radicalizes. And you see how they're struggling with this because, they're not designed for this. They don't have a public mandate. They don't have a clear set of policies about or didn't, what is and what is not acceptable. And so one of the really interesting developments is, whereas 2 years ago, right after the U.S. election, Facebook said, look, we have no responsibility. We played no role. All we do is connect people and let them share stories and pictures. Now Mark Zuckerberg is basically, pleading with the U.S. government to please work with them to establish a set of standards and policies because they need the legitimacy and ultimately sort of the enforcement support that only government can provide. Whether government is able and willing to do that in this case and in others is, of course, a completely different question.
I mean, but it seems to me that they're just the institutional mechanisms are lacking and also an idea of what it actually is. I mean, if you take this example, and I've done some work on this one in particular about, platforms and freedom of expression, it seems to me that there is a fundamental institutional misunderstanding at the core of this because these companies always say, we're about free speech. But they're trying to emulate the public square within their private constitution, which cannot work. So they don't have to provide freedom of speech. They're not a public place. They're a private company. Trying to emulate that public space within the boundaries of a private organization is bound to fail because you can never get away from the association, especially given that these house rules that they apply, they're not congruent anyway. I mean, the one example that I always use is pictures of nudity are banned from these platforms and they're obviously legal. So if they use their housekeeping rules basically to ban this type of content, why doesn't it apply to hate speech and other things? So it's a weak excuse saying we're trying to replicate the public space. This is bound to be a private space, but that seems to me like a constitutional conflict.
I think what I take from this and from these limitations, because I completely agree with you, is that even though we're seeing business becoming more political and there being at least examples of businesses doing the kinds of things that progressives and those who are concerned about, the future of the planet and social cohesion would be applauding, that does not mean that we can now get by without government, without public policy, right? I mean, in some ways, the limitations of these efforts, which are becoming apparent, and this is one of those examples, just highlight that there is no substitute for government, particularly government that functions as a representative democracy and does an effective job at aggregating interests and coming up with generalizable principles.
Yeah, I mean, my suggestion, which nobody at Facebook will take seriously, of course, was that, given that Mark Zuckerberg made this proposal of a Supreme Court, basically externalizing a judicial function, which suggests that it is about the enforcement of the rules, which is the problem. I think it's the rules themselves. And if you take on some sort of user democracy, because there's no right and wrong in these sort of things, there's only legitimate and illegitimate rules. Right. And at the end of the day, what is legitimate is what users think is legitimate. So if you provided some form of user democracy in actually setting up these rules, and also, again, coming back to the global business nature, I mean, what is culturally acceptable to users is completely different in different parts of the world. So you would have to be a one size fits all. It's not going to work on this scale. So, one way of, firms becoming more political, especially the huge digital companies, is in the terms of governance of their businesses, which have 2 billion users, unprecedented type of private organization. There is a reason why these organizational principles of the division of powers has been established as a workable way of organizing the public space. And if a company has a public sort of public product, with this kind of user involvement, it probably needs to take a book, a few lessons from politics into its own corporate governance.
I think that's right. You know, I agree with that. And, you know, there again, there's some inherent limitations in that because, you know, they don't have the same mandate. They do lack the legitimacy. You know, at the end, it's going to be private rules in a private place. You know, that's not going to satisfy everybody. But just as importantly, the procedural justice might be missing, leaving aside just the outcome, because they're just not set up for this, right? And so that's why they're sort of hoping to get government legitimacy for what it is that they're doing, because they're realizing that they can't really do it on their own.
Yeah, and it's interesting how these different products work. I mean, if you look at Google and YouTube, for instance, I mean, there seems to be much less outcry, let's say, if Google indexes websites with very questionable content, because the product is pointing to an external resource. But if it's, mm-hmm. a video is hosted on YouTube, it's hosted in your space that you yes. actually control rather than reference. It's the difference between controlling the space and referencing a different space that I think is also a qualitative difference in how people perceive the role of these companies.
I think that's right. But a lot of that is, again, about perception, right? Because you can argue that Google's indexing surfaces material and actually therefore makes it just as readily available. And this distinction about what is on my platform, what am I pointing to, may actually miss the point about the centrality of these sort of hubs in the network in connecting people to material. But you're absolutely right. You know, people do think of it differently.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a clear governance challenge here. And if it happens like this, economically speaking, it's a natural monopoly. And that means it needs regulation, as any other natural monopoly has had in economic history, really.
So, well, you know, we'll see if that now happens, right? I mean, you know, you get an increasing number of calls for breakups. It's not exactly clear how that will work. You talked about antitrust policy before. There are some parallels, but there are, of course, also, some important distinction, and the argument that many of these digital monopolists, starting with Microsoft and really ever since have made is, show me the harm to consumers. We're making all of this available for free just because there are network effects that are driving, people onto a single platform doesn't mean that we're abusing our dominant position. Even when you find some evidence of, searches and how your own affiliates end up ranking higher and so on. The argument is easy to say, well, the competition is just a click away. People could go elsewhere. They're not. What we're offering is of value and is free. People are voting with their feet. So it's completely different from the supply side monopolies of a previous era. These are demand side monopolies driven by network effects. And so we ought to treat them differently. And it's remarkable. Those issues were apparent 20 years ago, as I said, when the digital revolution started in many ways. And we still haven't seen, competition law and antitrust enforcement really catch up with the realities. And I think we're getting to a point now where we could be having sort of the paradigm defining intervention, if we think of, the breakup of AT&T, for example, in the early 80s in the U.S., is something like that becoming possible with one of those large digital platforms? We don't know, but the repercussions could be equally big as that momentous decision was 25 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, and I'm not necessarily saying we need to break them up, but I mean, in terms of how these companies operate, my experience is that they're not necessarily against, working with government, because sometimes the scale of their own products and the scale of their own success seems to overwhelm themselves as well. But I mean, how can we, and that's, I think, the critical thing also for policymakers, because, we try to straddle the spheres of policymaking and business here. I mean, if we've tried for 20 years, how can we improve that process of, working together to find sustainable solutions? Because there are obviously a lot of benefits that should be harvested. But, how can can this governance interface be improved? I think that seems to be a key question. I have no answer to that, but that's why I ask you.
I'm not sure I have a ready-made, you know, recipe as well. But, you know, the approach in Europe for a long time has been, you know, the commission provides a conference room and a coffee and invites stakeholders and let's have a conversation. And we end up with, you know, some co-regulation, you know, that that has the support and the input from business at the very beginning. In the U.S., of course, the process has been much more adversarial, with regulatory agencies putting out rules for comments and companies weighing in, and you know, regulators and promulgating rules, and you know, often that leading to court challenges and so on. I think neither one of those two systems is terribly effective. I would agree with you. And even in both of those models, there are a whole lot of voices that are excluded. You know, if you're not organized, very difficult to participate in that process. I think companies are beginning to figure out how to get input from a broader stakeholder community through stakeholder councils and engagement mechanisms, but also, quite frankly, through social media. I mean, social media monitoring is something that a lot of companies are taking very seriously now. And you know, I wouldn't go as far as some utopians perhaps go about that being a new type of democracy, quite the contrary, perhaps. But, you know, but you see a very direct kind of interaction between companies and stakeholders that they touch as a result of this. I think what we haven't done is sort of bring government back into that conversation, then sort of merging those models in an effective way. But I think increasingly, you know, companies are willing to engage, and they're looking for governments who can effectively work with them, and governments can bring their legitimacy, and business can bring their expertise, their know-how, their capital, but, you know, already pointed in a certain direction as a result of stakeholder input, you know, input from their customers, from their employees, from their shareholders, who are often, they're not ignorant of what some of these problems actually are, but they recognize that business alone can't get it done.
Yeah, so the public affairs function is probably changing quite dramatically. And at the same time, I mean, it's also the role of government to be responsive to stakeholders, including business. So and maybe governments have not done a great job being responsive beyond sort of election campaigns as well. So there is, you know, that's why I'm very much interested in this space, you know, the whole idea of create shared value, these sort of things. It's about creating institutional relationships and processes, really, of communication flows and engagement that might be able to, you know, deliver more effective results than we've seen in the last 20 years.
Yeah, I mean, when I look at a company and I try to figure out where are they on this journey, one of the most useful indicators is actually how internally this engagement with stakeholders is organized. Because the old model was exactly as you alluded to. You had your government affairs people, you had your legal people, you had some people focused on corporate communications, maybe somebody sort of charged with CSR or, you know, running the foundation. And two things used to be quite common. One was these different functions were not integrated in any kind of way. They were really seen as completely different functions aimed at different stakeholders that were dealing with different issues. And the second one was they were not tied in or plugged in into the broader strategic conversation that was happening in the enterprise. In many ways, their job was to sort of clear the path or deal with you know, some of the externalities that might result as the company, you know, proceeded on its market-oriented trajectory. And so I think the companies that are leading in this space now are the ones who are realizing that engagement with government, engagement with civil society, engagement with stakeholders writ large to communications, that all of these are basically just, you know, sides of the same coin. I mean, you're engaging in conversations with you know, with the public at large and with stakeholders. And you need to align these things. And so a lot of companies are bringing them together under senior positions in external affairs or in public affairs. So that's a really important trend. But the other one is that those people, those functions are then part of the strategy formulation process within the enterprise itself, rather than just an afterthought, right? So given how society is changing, given how, you know, what government interests and priorities are, given the pressure that we're getting from some of our constituents, what are some solutions that we could pursue? And it goes a little bit back to what I think you discussed with Colin about, you know, putting yourself in a position where you can actually find solutions to problems, right? And there are, you know, many examples now of companies that have taken that step, the integration across, and particularly then the sort of integration into the core strategy process in the enterprise.
Yeah, I mean, in traditional public affairs, you had the prevention element, you know, preventing regulation, preventing costs. You had the enabling element, which was, as you, I completely agree, a focus on markets, right? So develop new markets, create new opportunities. Yeah. But I think you have more and more this intelligent element, which goes towards the internal client, which is basically being the feelers, the social and societal feelers, and, you know, transport this kind of information into the strategy making, managerial decision making processes.
That's exactly right. And that is sort of, if you will, the organizational manifestation of what we talked about before, the notion that business is political. And political doesn't mean here, you know, partisan political, but understanding that the decisions that get made in business have real consequences for people, whether or not they're consumers or employees, and that you cannot isolate the enterprise from the implications of those decisions. And so you might as well have these sensors, these feelers, this engagement with the communities that you touch so that you can, first of all, you know, shape their perception of the enterprise, but just as importantly and increasingly, you know, gather intelligence, gather information, pick up sentiment, and make it part of the decision-making process as you're pivoting the enterprise increasingly towards what you described as shared value, right? Which are situations where you enhance the competitiveness of the enterprise while at the same time improving the community in which you operate. And that doesn't solve all problems. There are some real trade-offs between private interest and public good. But if we just got to a point where companies realized how many win-wins there are between helping themselves and helping the communities in which they operate, I think we'd be a lot closer to where we should be.
Oh, I absolutely agree. And it's great that you think that, you know, the way I try to rationalize these developments makes broadly sense. So that's a that's a great relief. David, thank you very much indeed. I think this is unfortunately all we have time for today. So, but there's a, you know, what we described is a very dynamic space. So we'll see how this develops over the coming years. But I'm absolutely sure that there's more trial and error in this area going forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Annie.
Thank you very much for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. Make sure you don't miss future episodes by subscribing to Social Europe Podcast. You can also read our articles on www.socialeurope.eu and follow us on Facebook and on Twitter @Social Europe. Until next time.